put in the middle there? Or?
Yeah, and if you could possibly lean in a bit just to make the sound.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so today's the 18th of October, 2011. It's 4:30. My name is Millie Lake, and this interview forms part of the Brand Responsibility Project housed at the University of Washington. So if I'll just begin by asking you to state your name and title for the record.
Lance Compa, Senior Lecturer, Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations.
Okay, perfect. So I just wanted to start by asking you to talk a little bit about your position here at the university and how you became involved in labor issues, if that's okay.
I'm on the faculty here where I teach courses on U.S. labor law, first of all, strictly domestic U.S. labor law, but also international labor law. That's become my specialty over the years. And so I teach courses on courses titled International Labor Law, another course titled Corporate Social Responsibility. I've taught courses on immigrant workers and labor rights in the United States and other relevant courses. I got involved in labor issues going back to when I first finished law school. I have a law degree, and I went to work in the trade union movement as a union side organizer and negotiator and lawyer, and did that for many years before I transitioned into the academy where I teach now.
Okay, thank you. And you're, am I right in thinking you're on the board of the licensing oversight committee here at Cornell, or?
I'm on the licensing oversight committee.
Okay.
It's not a board, it's the committee, and I'm a member of the committee, right?
And how long have you been a member of the committee since it started, or?
I don't think I was one of the original persons. I think Mike Powers asked me to join 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So if we start with the Nike case, if you could perhaps tell us what the issues were that were of concern to Cornell and how those issues, how you first learned of those issues.
The problem was the closure of a Nike factory in Honduras, which was producing Nike products without paying severance pay that was required under the Honduran labor laws. And the question was whether Nike had any responsibility to make the workers whole for the severance pay that they did not receive. That is, that Nike would pay the severance pay. The complication was that these workers were not employed by Nike. They were employed by the subcontractor of a subcontractor, and it's even more complicated than that. You know, there's no need to go walk through all that now. And it came to my attention the way it came to people's attention generally, I think. I follow these issues. I get alerts from the Worker Rights Consortium and United Students Against Sweatshops, and I'm on various listservs and, you know, internet notification ventures that like Labor Start, which is another website that has international labor news. So I think I found out about it as soon as it was made publicly known.
Okay, thanks. And could you then just talk us through how the process unfolded here at Cornell when the issue came to your attention, or when it came to your attention and the university's attention that there wasn't a problem with Nike? What course of action you took next?
Yeah, well, the university, Cornell participates in both the Worker Rights Consortium and the Fair Labor Association, and the case was quickly brought to the attention of those two multi-stakeholder bodies. And United Students Against Sweatshops made it a priority campaign in its work. At Cornell, we have a group, it's called COLA, Cornell Organization for Labor Action, but they are the Cornell United USAS affiliate. And as part of their USAS work with USAS, the national organization, the Cornell group made it a priority here and began calling for Cornell to take action against Nike, to convince Nike to satisfy the severance pay needs of the affected workers. And that took the form of general forms of student activism, demanding meetings with the administration, and there were some demonstrations. There's a public plaza area at the campus where I think demonstrations were held, leaflets were passed out, and so on. They also, I can't remember when in the sequence of things, but two of the workers who had suffered the consequences of this plant closing with no severance pay actually did a national tour, and they included Cornell in their tour. So they met with our licensing oversight committee in a small meeting, and they did a larger presentation to a bigger group of students.
Okay, and had COLA been engaged in this kind of, were there other actions similar to this previously, disregarding the Russell case for a moment, but were there other cases that we might not be aware of that the university was being pressured to take action on by
COLA's done a number of actions, not always related to sweatshop conditions in Latin America. A few years ago, for example, there were concerns about the treatment of meatpacking workers in the United States and violations of labor standards and labor conditions. And so COLA had some meetings with the administration to try to ensure that Cornell, which runs its own food services operation, it does not subcontract to some other group. Cornell has its own food services, and the students, you know, wanted Cornell to make sure that they were sourcing their meat products from places that treated workers well, and so on. So yeah, there have been other examples, but I have to say that the Nike and the Russell campaigns probably reached the highest level of activity and outcome as well.
Okay. So could you talk a little bit about the oversight committee, your processes and procedures for when an issue like this comes up?
It's not highly formalized. I've never seen, for example, a terms of reference for the committee. I think it's more of an ad hoc. It's formal in the sense that there is a committee, there are named members of the committee, but we usually respond to calls from Mike Powers, who's the administration's person who handles these things, and we meet and discuss, and we try to reach a consensus on these issues. It's an oversight committee, and it's basically advisory, so the committee does not have decision-making powers about these things. It makes recommendations, but then it's up to the administration and ultimately the president of the university to actually make the final hard decision.
So were most of your meetings at this point, after the issue came to your attention through the WRC, were the majority of the meetings discussions over whether or not you should recommend to the president to allow the contract to expire, or were there other kind of questions that came up as well?
That was the central question, whether to recommend Cornell doing whatever the technical steps were required to end this contractual mm-hmm. relationship. And you know, you would get into nuanced questions like, do we say, we want to cut off the contract right now, or do we say, well, we want to see progress, we want to see a solution, and then down the road. Part of the problem, if I remember right, with Nike is that we were in the middle of a contract with Nike, mm-hmm. and there were some contractual obligations that foreclosed the possibility of just stopping it right then and there. But we could say, well, when the contract expires, if this problem is not resolved, then we'll take steps. We didn't have more than three or four meetings, to be honest. So it's not like we meet on a regular schedule. It's very ad hoc, it's very informal.
And how long a period was this?
Probably over a 3 or 4 month period.
Okay.
When the campaign reached its, you know, a critical point when decisions really had to be made. And
would you say there was a lot of consensus on the committee, or were people kind of pushing different courses of action?
There were different points of views. The people from the athletic department who also participated in the committee, they were concerned about the effect of losing the Nike deal, because it was a good deal for them. Mm-hmm. You know, they get free uniform. I don't know exactly what the arrangement is, okay. but it's favorable to them.
Yeah.
So they were somewhat reluctant, or you know, they weren't leading the charge to cut off Nike, but they weren't. They saw the issues, I think, in an overall perspective, and so in the end, there was pretty much of a consensus.
Okay.
In the group, yeah.
And what was your position on whether or not to terminate the contract or allow the contract to expire, or did you have personal course of action?
you know, I'm a lawyer, so I'm not inclined to recommend breaking a contractual obligation mm-hmm. because you can suffer some consequences due to that. But I was in favor of the strongest action, possible action that was open to us without violating any other obligations. So I, you know, in my personal role, I pushed very hard to tell Nike that you've got to fix this or Cornell is going to end its relationship with Nike at the first opportunity.
And does Cornell have its own code of conduct with its licensees, or do you rely on the FLA code of conduct?
You know, I should know the answer to that. I
I meant to ask Mike that question.
Yeah.
No worries.
I think that Cornell relies on the Fair Labor Association and the Worker Rights Consortium's codes as the basis of its code. Now, you know, Cornell might have adopted something that reflects that, but the discussions were always about the WRC and the FLA codes.
Okay.
But it may be that Cornell has its own code. You know, I should know, but I don't know for sure.
The WRC and the FLA codes are fairly distinct from what I recall from previous.
There's a lot of overlap. There are some areas of distinction.
Areas.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well,
but I think they both. I mean, Ariella, do you know if Cornell has its own code?
I think Cornell has its own.
Okay. Yeah. 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 Okay. You should probably get hold of that.
Yeah, I will, and I'll.
Since a lot of the pushing was coming from the WRC and USAS, sort of pointed to the WRC code. That was most of the discussion. Most of the discussion centered on something that's probably in all three of the codes, which is, you know, the supplier factories to Nike are supposed to obey the laws of the country where they're in business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that simple.
Yeah.
And usually, you know, the reason it gets complicated is that when people wrote that clause, they probably weren't thinking about severance pay laws.
Mm-hmm.
Which runs into huge amounts of money. They were thinking about minimum wage laws or non-discrimination laws, things that are more bounded and easier to identify problems and probably easier to correct them. But this question of the severance pay for 1,000 people.
Yeah, and the chain of responsibility.
Yeah, right. That was the new issue that we had to confront.
So, yeah, it seems like the majority of discussions at the University of Washington committee meetings were on two distinct issues, whether University of Washington licensed goods had been produced at those factories,
mm-hmm.
which it was never entirely clear, and the second issue was disclosure of information by Nike's ability or inability to disclose whether or not that had been the case, and that was
mm-hmm.
the ultimate
mm-hmm.
kind of sticking point for the committee. So were they... was that comparable here in the meetings, or was it?
I don't think there was. There was a question of how much Nike production had been performed at that factory.
But it wasn't so much a question of whether Cornell's.
No, I mean Cornell had a relationship with Nike.
Yeah.
So, you know that was there. We didn't have to look around for some way to connect Cornell to Nike. Cornell was connected with Nike.
And there wasn't so much concern about whether Cornell goods had been produced in those specific factories, if Nike was responsible. Because I mean that was
right.
a big deal.
Right. No, it wasn't.
Okay.
It wasn't. But the question was, you know, Cornell and Nike are in a mutually beneficial relationship, but Nike is supposed to abide by these terms. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for that. Mm-hmm. And so where in these meetings was the majority of your information coming from? Was it mostly from WRC, or did you have direct communication with representatives from Nike? You mentioned that some of the employees had come to give presentations. But
yeah. I mean, we had information from various sources. The WRC, USAS was putting out information. There were some, I can't remember if the WRC and the FLA, there were independent reports. People were engaged to go down and do I might be conflating this with Russell because that also happened in Russell, but, you know, there were various sources. So it wasn't only the WRC, although the WRC was very active in this campaign and getting information out about it.
Okay.
And then, of course, the affected workers came to Cornell, and so we had direct interchange with them.
So let's just turn to the Russell case briefly, if that's okay. And I don't
mm-hmm.
want to spend too much time on that because I want to go back to Nike and some
mm-hmm.
other details of
mm-hmm.
the Nike case. But could you just relay the Russell case in a similar fashion to me, how what the issues were and yeah, how they yeah. came to your attention, and then how the committee proceeded.
In Russell, Russell closed a factory in Honduras where a union had recently been formed, and it was significant at the formation of the union because it was the first, or at least the most recent case of a significant factory gaining union representation, or workers gaining union representation. And Russell closed the factory, and there was the disputed issue was whether Russell closed it solely because of economic considerations without any anti-union bias, or if anti-union bias was actually the motivating factor. And the union at the factory and the Worker Rights Consortium and USAS and the advocacy community generally made the latter argument, mm-hmm. that it was motivated by anti-union bias. And Russell defended itself by saying, no, it was strictly an economic question. This particular product that they make in the factory was not doing well, and they had to consolidate operations and so on. that and people made their arguments, and again, the FLA and the WRC and there might have been others had various experts look at these questions and come up with findings and so on. And the findings themselves were somewhat debatable or in dispute. So it was never, when you think about it, it's impossible to prove what's in somebody's heart of hearts. I mean, Russell is not going to say we closed the factory because we didn't want the union.
Yeah.
You know, so it's one of those things that's impossible to prove. So basically, it came down to the campaign then, and whether the campaign would be successful in having Russell correct this perceived injustice, whether or not, you know, regardless of what the motivation was.
Okay.
And it came to our attention in the same way, generally. The workers and the affected workers and their union, the CGT in Honduras, they have allies in the United States and in NGOs and in USAS and the WRC and so on, so they turn to them. A general alarm is put out to this advocacy community at large, and people start organizing and acting. And since it implicated, again, universities, I mean, a big part of Russell's business, this is why there was leverage in the university community, because a big part of Russell's business involved the university apparel and sell, you know, Russell selling its goods to universities and in university bookstores and so on.
Okay, and so how, in both of these cases, how important do you think, it seems like there's a lot of faculty at Cornell who are very active in this area, but how important would you say that student activism was for keeping these issues on the agenda? Do you, like, how?
You know, on a scale of 100, the student activism is 99% of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, faculty, you know, there's only so much we can do. We write our articles and so on, and maybe the article gets published in a year and a half, and, you know, by then, who cares?
Yeah.
So the student activism really was the key. I mean, I think that, you know, first of all, organizing and the solidarity on the ground in Honduras, you know, that's the genesis of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact that USAS and the student affiliate groups at Cornell and other universities really took this on as a campaign priority and pushed their administrations to take action, that's really what swung the campaign.
Okay. And could I ask you to speculate a little bit, and I appreciate you don't know what was going on, you know, specifically with the corporations, with Nike and with Russell, but what you perceived in your interactions with their representatives, what you perceived their primary concerns to be throughout these negotiations?
I never had any direct interchange with Russell officials at that time. I have since then.
Okay.
At the time, I wasn't involved, so I don't know what was going on between Russell and Cornell or the other universities.
Okay.
During the campaign phase.
Okay, mm-hmm. And with Nike, do you have? Did you have direct conversations with Amanda Tucker or Caitlin or?
Not during the campaign phase. Later on, after the situation was resolved, they asked me to oversee the payment system for recompensing. If that's a word, the workers who did not get their severance pay.
Okay, so we'll talk about that in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then why were you surprised by the outcomes of these two cases? Did you expect that Nike and Russell would both come come to the, or the cases would be resolved in the ways that they were, or not?
Since it was a campaign that developed over time, as the campaign accelerated and escalated, I became more and more convinced that Nike and Russell, in each case, they're going to have to do something about this. Early, when it first started, and they were both digging in their heels, I mean, you know, Nike first said, well, we have no responsibility for the subcontractor of a subcontractor who didn't pay the severance pay. And Russell said, we closed that factory for strictly economic purposes, and that factory is gone, and, you know, stop bothering us. Mm-hmm. At that point, I thought, well, if they're really digging in, it's going to be tough to get them to change. But as the campaign got traction and kept on going, I started thinking they're going to have to do something. So by the time they did something, it was a pleasant surprise, but not a shock. If somebody had said, when it first started and they were really digging in their heels, if somebody had said, you know, actually, you're going to win this in the end, I think I would have been surprised.
Okay. And so it's evident that USAF has incredible connections, you know, cross-campus connections across the country. Mm-hmm. Did you have connections or conversations with representatives from other schools as well, or?
No.
No, okay. No. That seems to be fairly common among most of the faculty administrators I've spoken to. It seems quite the cross-campus activism was really.
I mean, I know faculty at other universities who are working in this field. It's their area of scholarship and research, but we coordinated. Here's what we're going to tell our administration. Yeah. There was none of that I'm aware of. At least I didn't.
That certainly didn't take place at the University of Washington, but I just wondered if it had been different.
No.
Okay, and then if you could just say something about the role of universities in general in pressuring corporations, because one of our research questions has been why, given that university contracts don't necessarily represent a massive financial component of multinational corporations' contracts, why they decided to kind of...
Yeah, well, I wouldn't minimize the economic force of the university's relationship to these brand name companies, because taken in the aggregate, it's a multi-billion-dollar business.
Okay.
Less so at Cornell. I mean, the thing that Cornell brought, I think, was the Ivy League brand.
Yeah.
You know, compared with some of the big state schools that are the football powerhouses and the basketball powerhouses. I mean, Cornell is not Duke or Notre Dame. Or Washington, for that matter, when it comes to athletics, these are companies where the brand is that's their prize.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these companies, the brand is their prize, and having a relationship with an Ivy League school is also, reflects well on them and on the brand and so on. So that gave Cornell, I think, some leverage that. Maybe it wasn't economically as much as Duke or Notre Dame, but in terms of the companies not wanting to have this this tarnish on their brand because a respected university like Cornell broke its relationship with us because of this. So I think the universities have quite a bit of sway in these debates and issues.
Yeah, and it seems something that's come up a bit as well is just the prestige of having the corporations kind of expect that NGOs and student groups will make allegations such as this, but there's something very credible about a university formally taking a position on
this
might also influence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit, if that's okay, about your role in overseeing the distribution. Would you be prepared to talk about what your role is?
It's very, very straightforward. This is in the Nike situation where Nike ultimately agreed to pay the severance pay that the workers had not received from their primary employer, which was a subcontractor of Nike. Mm-hmm. And Nike agreed to pay it, and Nike and the union and the WRC and the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center in Central America, they were also part of this mix. They asked me to be a neutral overseer of the payment system and the actual payout to the affected employees. And I agreed to do that. And I've sent two reports to the, I mean, you know, the agreement with me called for an interim report and a final report, and I supplied those two reports. I honestly don't know if they're, I shouldn't think that they're confidential, but I would have to get permission from them if I were to share them at all. But I don't mind talking about them. It's not like there was a big secret, because what I found was that everything was done correctly and on the up and up. I got lists of employees. I got copies of bank statements. I got copies of bank records about, you know, the transfer of each individual's payment to that individual's bank account and stuff like that. So I was able to verify that not all, because when you're talking about 1,000 people, there's going to be some slippage, you know, but all but a handful of people who couldn't be located for one reason or another, and, you know, maybe they died for all I know. In a group that large, you're not going to find every single individual to give him or her the money, but it's clear that the union extended itself as far as possible to identify people. Okay. The people came in and got their money. You know, they signed the papers for about, you know, so it was all signed receipts. Everything was done very properly. Okay. It was clearly a really good organizing and bookkeeping job by the union people who administered it on the ground.
Okay. And how, I mean, I guess this was perhaps proportionate to the individual employees. Could you give an average of how much the employees kind of took home from the settlement, or is that just too diverse?
It's very diverse because it was based on years of service. Yeah. So obviously somebody with 10 years got twice as much as somebody with 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember the exact, it was on the order of a few hundred dollars. You know, it's a low wage country, right? So a few hundred dollars actually goes a long way. You could probably, I mean, there was a sum, right? Was it 1.7 million?
1.7 million.
You know, divide that by the number of people.
Employees.
And yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
If there were 1,000 employees, then they got, what's that, $1,700 per?
Yeah.
If I'm doing the math right?
Yeah.
Because 170 would be 170 would be too little, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and then what have you heard in these reports? Have you heard much about what the workers have been doing since in terms of the priority rehiring, the vocational training program, or has that not been?
It's not been part of my responsibility, okay. So I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I think like a long time ago, the WRC, which is, I think, staying closer to the situation, put out a report about rehiring and whether Nike was doing the best it could. But I really don't know anything about that. That would be pure speculation.
Okay, no worries. We can follow up with WRC.
Mm-hmm.
And do you, you probably don't know this figure off the top of your head, but one thing that's just come up in the last couple of days is we were trying to work out what percentage of the US sportswear market collegiate apparel represents. I just wondered if you happen to have an idea of that or...
I don't.
You don't. Don't worry.
I don't.
We can.
But it's
do,
you
do
know it's probably a small percentage, but a big absolute number because
yeah.
You know, it's a big industry.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered most of my questions, and there may be other things that come to mind when I review the transcript. So
mm-hmm,
if it would be
mm-hmm.
all right for me to possibly give you a follow up call.
Sure.
Or
no problem.
An email.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty much it.
Okay.